So with that, we'll move into WACs 220-415-020 and 220-415-030, and those cover deer general seasons and special permits. So we've kind of taken a little bit different approach in how we've structured the information to share with the commission today. And so we'll go over the recommendations first that aren't really specific to any of the mule deer management zones that we have. I'll give a brief statewide overview, and then I'm going to give a status update and recommendations for each deer management zone that we have in the state. And then I'll summarize public comment, and then I'll take questions. But also after each species of deer that I cover, I have a slide in there for we can take a break and ask questions specific to those. So for deer special permits, we added language that clarifies the bag limits one deer, even if permits are drawn in more than one permit category. We've actually done this for all of our ungulate species permit WACs, and the reason is every year we still have some hunters that think if they drew a doe permit and a buck permit that they get to go kill two deer. And there are instances when you're allowed to kill two deer, but it has to be specific to that opportunity. And so we're just putting that in rule to clarify it for folks that you don't get to kill two deer just because you drew permits in two different categories. We also added 10 antlerless permits for modern firearm and muzzleloader youth hunters and designated areas of Region 3. Anytime you see that designated area classification, that's in instances where we're responding to damage mitigation or anything like that. And so as they draw the permit, they're going to probably be put in contact with the conflict specialist. Hey, I need a hunter here. We'd like to have a youth opportunity. And so that's kind of general in nature. So another one is our hunter education instructor incentive permits. We're increasing the number of permits for any white-tailed deer in Region 1 from 2 to 3, increasing the number of permits for any deer in Region 4 from 2 to 4, and increasing the number of permits for any deer in Region 6 from 2 to 4. So now we'll move into deer in general, and I want to start with just kind of reminding the commission and members of our audience that we've had some recent weather events that have really had an effect on our ungulate populations. And so starting with the drought that occurred in 2015, this was one of the most severe droughts that we'd had on record in recent time in Washington. The graphs that I have up there, the figures I have up there, show you what it looked like. The severity index in 2015, the two other drought years we had were in 2001 and 2005, and what we saw in 2015 was exceptional compared to those 2 years. This was also an event that occurred west-wide. It wasn't just specific to Washington. I don't know if folks remember the fire season that happened in 2015. It was a record fire season for Washington and across the West. This same year, we had record die-offs of sockeye salmon in the Columbia, record die-offs of sturgeon. That entire fishery was closed down that year. And we had a large region-wide blue tongue outbreak that not only affected eastern Washington, but was also felt strongly in Oregon and Idaho as well. And then the next year, the winter of 2016 and 2017 hit. And that was a long, cold, deep snow winter. And the effects of that were substantial on ungulate populations across the West. That received national level attention. Idaho documented large declines in their deer and elk populations. Oregon documented declines. Montana, Colorado. I mean, the list goes on. So just to give you a quick, this is our statewide deer harvest. What's in here that you see is general season and permit season combined. And so you do kind of see those trends. I highlighted those years following the drought. So after the drought of 2015, our harvest declined substantially in 2016. And then after that winter event in 2016-2017, we saw another statewide drop in our harvest. We've been a little bit more steady the last 3 years. It's tapered off, but there's still been a slight decline. The trends that you see here at a statewide level do not play out across all of our deer populations in Washington. We're going to see that as we proceed through this presentation. So we'll start with black-tailed deer. So all my figures on deer are going to look like this. So I want to take a little bit of time to just orient folks with what we're seeing up here. So the blue bars are general season harvest only. And I'll get to why we're limiting it to general season here in just a second. These other two gray bars, we've got a solid gray bar, and then below that we've got a dashed line. And so that is tied to our at-risk ungulate assessment. So our definition of that is any ungulate population which falls 25% below its population objective for two consecutive years, and or if the harvest decreases by 25% below the 10-year average rate, harvest rate for two consecutive years. So for blacktail, we don't do surveys. We do very limited number of surveys for whitetail. Those are ground surveys. We're not trying to estimate abundance. And even for mule deer, where we do get up and do flights, we don't have numeric objectives for our mule deer populations. For all three species, our objective is to manage for stable or increasing populations, and we're primarily using harvest as the indicator of that. And general season harvest is going to be more indicative of population trends than permit season harvest. So we're using the second part of this definition, harvest. And so the dotted line at the bottom is showing 25% below the 10-year mean. The 10-year mean is the solid line. And then that larger bolded text at the top, that number is the 10-year average. And I was able to fit in preliminary harvest estimates for 2019 in these slides as well. So we'll start with a black-tailed deer. So we've got five management zones that we've identified for black-tailed deer: the North Cascades, South Cascades, Willapa Hills, Olympics, and then out in the islands in the Puget Sound. So I know it's a lot to keep track of where all these places are. So in each one of my slides in the upper left-hand corner there, there's going to be a statewide overview, and that blue shaded area is going to kind of tell you where in Washington are we when we're covering this stuff. And then I'm not going to go in detail on each of these graphs and talks about trends. What I want folks to key into and pay attention to is that year 2016 to 2017, where we see a substantial decline in our harvest following that harsh winter of 2016-2017. So with the South Cascades, black-tailed deer management zone, harvest overall pretty steady. We did see that decline. We don't have a lot of changes proposed here. We changed the legal deer from any buck to any deer and GMU 654 during the late muzzleloader season. The local biologists proposed that change just to make it consistent with the GMUs around it, because this was the only GMU in that area that allowed any buck rather than any deer, and she had received feedback from enforcement that made it difficult. Can we standardize that? So that's what we did. We have just a few adjustments in our quality permits, reducing those from 9 to 7. And then our buck permits, we eliminated a youth opportunity in GMU 485 and replaced it with a disabled permit. So in that GMU, we work with the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe to set permit levels. And what they've agreed to is alternate those opportunities between youth and disabled every other year. So that's what that change is associated with. We see a large number of antlerless permit reductions in the southern and the unit. These are mostly associated with senior hunters and disabled. The reason for that was we were having very, very low participation rates on those hunts, and so the bio removed those and was trying to come up with, is there a place that I can give better opportunity with better participation? So the Olympic Blacktail Deer Management Zone, we have no changes proposed for general season. The reductions that we have in antlerless permits, again, are mostly associated with 65 and older and disabled hunters. And again, it was for the same reason. A lot of the GMUs weren't a good fit for disabled hunters, and he kind of reduced those and then replaced it with opportunity elsewhere. The Willapa Hills, we have no changes proposed for general seasons there. For our special permits, we have a slight increase in our quality permits, where the buck permits were reduced just by two, and then the antlerless permits were increased by roughly 25. In the North Cascades, we have no changes proposed for general or special permit seasons. Harvest there had kind of been showing this just gradually increasing trend until the winter of 2016-2017, and then it has since recovered. So out on the islands, there's no changes proposed for general seasons. Our management on the islands is really focused on trying to control deer numbers. We have a lot of islands where we feel like there's actually too many deer on those islands, but facilitating opportunity out there is very difficult. We are, again, trying to respond to that increase in deer numbers, and so the local biologist has proposed increasing antlerless permits out there by quite a few, almost 100. So with that, do we have any questions on blacktail?
And maybe it needs to be picked up later, but I do have a question with regard to the 25% threshold on ungulate populations, and I'm generally aware that how it's been built into the management plans and the like, but can you explain why it's 25 and not, say, 20, or why it's a 10-year average and not some other time period? And I think it will apply to further discussions today. So.
I can't speak to when they, so that was initially defined in the wolf management plan. And I wasn't part of that group that decided on the metric that we use and, you know, incorporated into our management plans. So I can't really speak to that. What I can say is that definition is somewhat ambiguous. You know, what do you mean by harvest? There's been question about should that be a solid 10-year mean, because if it's a moving average, right, over time, you may never get to that point. We do think in some places we need to be more explicit about what that means to us and how we're using that. And it is a discussion that we've had internally about when we update the game management plan, we need to revisit that. And we need to be more specific about what we're doing with that.
So those that threshold was created, as Brock mentioned, during the SEPA process for the wolf management plan, and again during the SEPA process through the game management plan. And oftentimes the reason we pick a 25% number or something in the 20s is that's oftentimes the smallest number we can measure and feel comfortable with as far as if a decline actually occurred because of the ranges around a lot of these estimates. And so that's the rationale that a lot of times we say 20 to 25, but in this instance we picked 25, and that was through public engagement and other things to that effect.
Questions? Okay. Mr. Linville.
I have a few concerns, and I'm like Commissioner Anderson, this probably could have come at the end, but I'll just get it out now. I have a little bit of concern with how clearly the drought and the bad winter are being pointed out, because I feel like that is leaning towards causation. And I feel like that's a little bit, we don't know that that's causation necessarily, certainly a contributing factor, no question. And then in each of these, because I've gone through the data, we are running up against that gray line every single time. And my concern with that is this is just from hunting data, right? So that's not necessarily, we could have crossed over a threshold already in the general population, especially antlerless, you know what I mean, does. And so I'm just struggling with, I'm really struggling with how, you know, that, okay, this just happens because of drought, and, you know, this number, we're right up against that gray line, and it feels like this is enough information for me to say we're in pretty big trouble here. I don't know, trouble might be a bit much, but, you know, this seems very, very, very concerning to me. And so it feels like status quo or business as usual is maybe a little worrisome.
So is your concern specific to blacktail, or are you
so sorry. But I've gone through the rest of the slides, and they're all very similar, where they're running it right up against that gray line. I'm just concerned about business as usual on this.
So I think, there's some, when we get into mule deer and whitetail, there's definitely some examples there where, you know, we need to take a look at this probably, or we need to really be watching this. So the other thing that we're trying to get at by incorporating that into these presentations is being more transparent about it and being, you know, coming forward and saying, hey, we are watching this and see where we're at. We're not where we want to be. We want to see those go up. As far as the comment related to causation, I do think we can make that link. And the reason is because we saw the deer carcasses that, you know, died of blue tongue. We documented that. I think you'll hear some folks today echo that. You know, there was concerns. That was seen. The winter effects, that was seen. I mean, the number of elk carcasses after that drought year that they observed during their flights in the Clackam, it was unprecedented. And so in those instances, I do think you can get to causation. I think what we're not saying is that's the only thing that was at play. I think we have to acknowledge that there's other factors in there, and predation is definitely something that's always a factor for these ungulate populations.
So I really appreciate that, and I think it's a perception. This felt like we weren't saying that predation is contributing. There is no question. We've all seen winter kill. We've all seen blue tongue. I mean, there's no question those things. But it almost feels, and it's just a feel, not a, it feels like maybe we're dancing around that predation isn't a fairly significant factor in this. And so I just want to point that out so that we can always like be really shed a light on, you know, what people are thinking. And so anyway, I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think the other point is to make, you know, why I'm pointing those out is it's those abiotic events, those stochastic weather events that probably cause those substantial, you know, declines very quickly. Mm-hmm. But I also think we have to acknowledge that the recovery trends that we're seeing, that's probably where predation is playing a bigger role, right? Not so much in those year-to-year changes where you see that large of a change in harvest and ungulate populations, but it's probably part of the story as we're trying to watch those trends go up and we're trying to reduce antlerless harvest to speed that process up. Certainly, there's possibly other things we could do to speed that up.
Commissioner Thorburn.
Thank you, Brock, and also my fellow commissioners for raising the issues that you have. I do think this is better transparency than we've seen, and I appreciate the information that you're providing, and recognize that what we're talking about are some things that are kind of in stone right now because of SEPA processes. But the points that you've raised as we move into the next steps on these SEPA processes, looking at the threshold setting and the setting the 10-year averages, and is that rolling? And, I know that's been raised by our constituents. I know you're looking at other ways of doing population and that sort of thing, and just let's get it on the table. I think we're all going to be interested in looking at these matters as we move forward with these processes.
Absolutely. All right, so with mule deer, so we'll move into mule deer now. We really had steady harvest rates from 2001 till about 2014, and then we see that substantial decline after the drought, and then again after the severe winter. We've kind of rebounded a little bit. We just kind of talked about that. We have seen a slow uptick the last 3 years in our mule deer harvest and our populations. We also have survey data that indicates our fawn to doe ratios have come back up to what we are normally expect to see. So those are all good things. But again, the trend that we see for mule deer statewide doesn't necessarily play out as we go into each mule deer management zone. So for mule deer, we have a mule deer management plan. We identify 7 mule deer management zones in that plan. And so the data here is summarized at that level. So we'll start down in the southeast part of the state. We'll start in the Blue Mountains. Our buck to doe ratios have been at objective. Our fawn to doe ratios have hovered around our long-term average, between 55 and 60 fawns for every 100 does. And for this year, we have no proposed changes for general or special permit seasons.
When does the fawn to doe ratio get sampled? Like, does the fawn have to hit a certain age?
We start our surveys the week after Thanksgiving and run them through usually around mid-December is the goal to get done. By the end of December, some bucks have started shedding antlers, and then after that, once that happens, you're limited to a fawn to adult ratio. And so that's why we do our mule deer surveys when we do.
Thank you.
So moving into the Columbia Plateau, this covers a very large area. We actually have this broken down into 3 subherds, and we alternate our aerial surveys among those 3. We try to hit one every third year. Our buck to doe ratios have been an objective. Our fawn to doe ratios, they've hovered around the long-term average, usually in the 65 to 70 range, or they in some subherds in Douglas County that have actually been increasing in recent years. We have no changes proposed for general seasons in this mule deer zone, and we've added 5 archery buck permits in GMU 379. And then our antlerless permits, they reduce those permits by 350 because they, from the last point where they did a population estimate, they did see a slight dip in that population estimate, and they said, well, let's be conservative and let's see if we can help a little bit more. And so they took off 50 permits from what we proposed last year. So in the East Columbia Gorge, we initiated formal surveys in this mule deer management zone in 2016. We're still developing those, trying to get them to a point where we feel comfortable estimated abundance, but we do ratios there. Our buck to doe ratios have been at objective. Our fawn to doe ratios have been stable and have been in the right around 60 per 100. For this year, the general season change that we had was that we extended the season for archery buck permits in deer area 5382 to include September 1 through 25 and December 1st through 8th. So that's our Simcoe unit. That was a a big acquisition we made a few years ago. And the reason they proposed this change is because archery, we had low participation. When we reached out to the archers and said, hey, why aren't you guys going in September? They said it's just too hot. We'd like to have a later, cooler season opportunity, and so that's what we've proposed here. After we saw the decline in harvest that we did following that winter event, our population surveys, again, even though we haven't got them to where we're comfortable saying what the estimate is, our biologists pulled back on almost all antlerless opportunity in that unit. The few remaining permits we had were these disabled permits and 65 and older. Almost nobody was using that opportunity, and also just to show, hey, we're taking away opportunity from all user groups trying to recover this mule deer population. And I think, you know, Commissioner Linville, I imagine this is probably one that you look at where you say, yeah, but we're right on the cusp. And we are going to initiate discussions and start initiating discussions internally about, hey, we're right here at this point of where we say we're going to do something. And so what next step should we be considering, you know, in accordance with what's been outlined in the predator-prey guidelines and the game management plan? It clearly states in there that you need to show an attempt to change these trends with harvest first before you can consider anything else. The other exciting thing about this deer population is that I don't know how many of you are familiar with Secretarial Order 3362. So it was a Department of Interior funded initiative to focus research on important big game winter range and migration corridors. Over two proposal cycles, we actually were able to bring in $600,000 from that. And our most recent proposal is we're going to be putting 100 radio collared mule deer on this landscape next spring or next winter. We'll collar those animals. And so that collar data is going to tell us a lot, you know, about what are cost-specific mortality rates and what's overall survival of does. So we're excited about that.
Mr. Baker?
When you say we're going to put animals, you mean collar, not relocate, correct?
Yeah, okay. I should have spoken more clearly. We're gonna capture them and put a radio collar on. Okay. Yep. So now we'll move into the East Slope Cascades. This mule deer management zone is probably one of our highest profiles. It covers the Okanagan area. It covers Chelan County. Those are high producers of mule deer. That's the classic mule deer hunt. We break it up into three subherds because it's such a large area, and they break out basically by county, Okanagan County, and we do a Met House survey and then an Okanagan survey within that, and then Chelan County, and then the southern part, we don't have large deer numbers there, and so in prioritizing funds, we haven't done surveys there for quite some time. But in this zone, that's where we got our first round of secretarial order money. And we did put out, so we have the 100 mule deer collars that are out in accordance with, associated with the predator prey study. And so with the first round of secretarial order money that we received, we put an additional 100 radio collars out in the southern portion of this zone. So again, we're going to be, in the next few years, we're going to be learning a lot about survival and what causes of mortality are and how these deer are using these landscapes. Our buck-to-doe ratios in the northern subherd have declined in recent years to levels that are somewhat at the lower end of our objective. Our objective statewide is 15 to 19 bucks for every 100 does. And so the special permit reductions that you see over there on the right, that's tied to that. And our fawn-to-doe ratios in this zone had been below historical levels for the last 3 or 4 years, ever since the you know, that area was hit by extensive fires. We had the Carlton Complex fire. I think that was the one in 2014. And then right behind that was the Okanagan Complex fire. And together, I think it was like 900,000 acres of prime mule deer habitat was burned up. And so we actually increased antlerless harvest because we felt like there was going to be a habitat component that was limiting that population. We didn't want it to negatively affect the recovery. Since that, we've pulled that antlerless harvest off. It's not at the levels that it was immediately in response to those events. We've seen an increase, a little slight increase in harvest. And then, like I said, this year was the first year that our fawn to doe ratios came back to what they've historically been for that zone. And we have no proposed changes for the general season.
Mr. Anderson.
So the 2015 harvest number on the east slope is reflective of that more generous season. Is that why it spiked?
Actually not. People have theories of why harvest, but you actually see a spike in 2015 harvest across for a lot of our deer zones. That was that extensive drought year, because the antlerless harvest that we put in place in response to that, those were permits. There wasn't, you know, we didn't say, okay, any modern firearm general season hunter can now go kill an antlerless deer. So these harvest charts are limited to general season opportunities. In 2015, when that drought hit, like I said, you see that spike in a lot of them. It's just a theory, but because of that drought, it concentrated deer. Potentially, it could have concentrated deer and made them more susceptible to harvest. But I don't have, other than that, I don't have a good theory. Yep. To me, when I look at that, that's an outlier. I mean, I don't, you know, did harvest really double? That's hard to... That's hard to get there. But these are estimates like every other estimate, and sometimes you get those wonky results. So we'll move into the Nechis zone, and this is just right around Yakima, north of Yakima, basically between I-90 and Yakima. Historically, surveys were conducted in spring to estimate abundance. We've had several declines in deer numbers here that aren't even completely reflected in this chart. One was related to an EHD outbreak there, and there was a substantial decline. And so now we had pulled back on all antlerless harvest. There was only general season buck harvest, and because of that, they weren't going out and doing population surveys anymore. There's a mix of black-tailed deer and mule deer in this zone, and that makes it very difficult for them to get in a helicopter and accurately classify these deer. And so because of that, they would do ground surveys in December to estimate ratios, but they haven't been conducted since 2017 because when they go out and do it, they just don't see enough deer to get a good estimate. And we have no changes proposed for general or special permit seasons. This is another one, Commissioner Linville, where we're going to initiate discussions, and this is the herd that, right, it's overlaying the Yakima elk herd as well, and we have concerns with the Yakima elk herd as well, and we'll cover that in the elk section, but this is another place where, yeah, you're right, we're right there at that cusp. We need to be paying attention. So moving into the northern Rocky Mountain mule deer management zone, this is up in the northeast part of the state. Mule deer occur throughout the zone, but in very low numbers. In this part of the neck of the woods, white-tailed deer are the management priority, and there's no formal surveys for mule deer in this zone, and we have no proposed changes for general or permit season opportunities. So moving into the west, into the Okanagan Highlands, mule deer again are present throughout the zone, but they're much more common in the western portion, and then as I'll cover in whitetail, when you move to the east portion of the zone, it becomes more whitetail dominated. There's no formal surveys for mule deer, and we've made no proposed changes for general or special permit seasons. So with that, do we have any questions on mule deer?
Commissioner McIsaac and then Commissioner Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you could look at slide 30, the one I think right, well, slide 30. So in a similar manner to the East Gorge and one of the others where it's dipped below the dotted line and you're saying now we're going to start to take a look at it. When this went down to 63, was there any response in the regulations that you would say caused that to go up to 90 and go up to 124? Or does this get to that question of when you're at 25%, it's the smallest you can measure, and there's not enough precision when you're around this dotted line to try to do anything? So did something cause that, or is that just within the natural jump?
So I think your comment about the variation around the estimate, that becomes very relevant in areas where you're not harvesting very much, right? So even that harvest estimate is an estimate. And so when you start thinking about the respondents, and especially when we do a follow-up WSU survey and we take that and we try to correct a very small number to begin with, I think a lot of that up and down is tied to that. Because I can't explain to you why we had 333, you know, deer harvested in this GMU in 2001, and then the next year it was 159. I mean, I think a lot of that's probably explained to the uncertainty associated with, you know, our estimates. And the smaller you go down trying to pick that apart, the more that variation is. That's why we have more confidence in our statewide harvest estimates, and then at a regional level, and then once you get down to district and GMU, that uncertainty is just growing and growing and growing the more you do that.
Mr. Anderson.
Yes, I'd like to address the like the three-year period of 2017, 18, and 19 in the, on the various slides. I think slide 27, oops, plus to 31. Now I'm looking for my information. The those numbers seem to be pretty flat for, you know, they don't seem to be increasing as significantly as I would have thought. And I guess maybe it's, can you tell me about your perspective on that? Is what, try to say what's happening there, or, and maybe that's the whole subject of the discussion here, but.
Yeah, so I think it is. I think, so I, am I on the right slide? But they all have that similar trend, right? So in 2017, you know, we substantial decline. We pulled back on antlerless harvest, which should have reversed that. And we would expect it to reverse it pretty quickly, but we're not seeing that response. Right? That's the question. And I think that's where, yeah, I think we need to go back. And yeah, we're right at the line, but we need to go back and say, hey, in most instances, we can pull all antlerless harvest and we should expect these populations to go up. And they haven't done that. And so I think we do need to be honest and transparent and say, well, then in accordance with the predator-prey guidelines, what do we do here? What's our next step? Right? Because it says you may investigate, you may go out and say, well, we don't have enough information, or you may feel like you have enough information and you can consider implementing predator management actions. That's not a discussion we've had yet, and I think that's a discussion we do need to start having. What's our next step?
So
Mr. Thorburn,
in the interest of transparency, if we pull back on antlerless, we're not going to probably see it the next year, though. It's going to be, there is going to be a year lag, so we're only talking about 3 years, maybe not yet showing that we've had a result. Nonetheless, I don't want to take this as, please, let's take a look at these areas where we're having trouble, but yeah. I do think it's kind of a short time to see a trend as a result of the harvest action that we've taken.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that all ties to also the ambiguity with,
yeah,
kind of how this was, you know, is laid out now, because I think you're right. So, you know, you've pulled back on antlerless, but what if we had another winter 2016, 2017 that caused another substantial decline, right? What do we do then? Or how long do we stick to this? So how many years do we need to say, well, we've had no antlerless harvest, no female harvest, no adult female harvest, but we're not seeing the responses that we expected. How long do you do that? Especially if you're hanging right here at this line, right? We're right at that cusp of meeting the definition. So what do we do? So with that, we'll jump into whitetail deer. Very similar. Here's our white-tailed deer. We see that drought effect. We don't see quite as large of effect in that severe winter of 2016-2017. I think one of the reasons we didn't see it quite as large in white-tailed deer is because they occur at lower elevations. They're not up in the Cascades. That's a seems like a reasonable explanation. And then white-tail statewide kind of harvest trends are really driven by what we do in the Northeast. And so this most recent decline in total general season harvest is probably associated with the fact that we didn't allow any general season antlerless harvest last year. That, you know, we implemented that rule last year. And when we dig down to the zone level and the district level, you'll see that. So white-tailed deer, our white-tailed deer management plan, it has recently expired, but it identified 6 white-tailed deer management zones. This is how they're laid out across the state. I can tell you that we're going to start updating the process to update the white-tailed deer management plan. It's been out of date for a while. And one of the things we're going to look at is changing these zones and how they're defined. These were really defined just based on habitat, but there's administrative boundaries there that matter. Like the Palouse zone, it crosses the Snake River. Well, those whitetail are not, that's not a connected population. And so we are going to be looking at changing some of these zones in the near future. So we'll start in the southeast with the Blue Mountains. We conduct pre-hunt ground surveys down there. Our ratio estimates vary widely from year to year. The average fawn to doe ratio is 51 per 100. The average buck to doe ratio is 42. Our 2019 estimates were very similar. We removed opportunity to harvest antlerless white-tailed deer in GMU 166 during the early archery season. And then we've just got some minor adjustments in some youth permits in antlerless. And then they reduced the quality buck permit from 2 to 1 in deer area 1040. So nothing major. In the Columbia Basin, white-tailed deer occur in very low numbers. This is a really, really big area, and we're only harvesting between, you know, 150 and 200. They're not a common species out in the Columbia Basin. By definition, they meet the criteria of an at-risk ungulate population because they've been 25% below that 10-year mean, but they're not the management priority out there, and that's probably not some place where we would consider implementing predator-prey guidelines. We don't have any formal surveys, and we don't have any proposed changes for general or special permit seasons. So in the North Cascades, again, white-tailed deer occur in very low numbers up there. Mule deer are the management priority in this zone. We have no formal surveys, and we have no proposed changes for general or special permit seasons. As we move east into the Okanagan Highlands, as I mentioned earlier, white-tailed deer occur throughout, but they're most prominent in the east portion, which is GMU 101. We do some pre-hunt ground surveys in that zone in the eastern half, but generally our sample size is very small. That survey is mostly going out to check on mule deer. Usually we see less than 100 whitetail, and the average buck to doe ratio from that hovers around 32. And we have no proposed changes for general or special permit seasons in this zone as well. So as we move south into the Palouse, white-tailed deer occur throughout because of that Snake River divide. That zone's kind of split into two. We've got the north zone, north of the Snake River and south. Once you move south into the Blues, mule deer become the priority, so we don't do surveys down there for whitetail. And the north part, we do a pre-hunt ground survey. Buck-to-doe ratios fluctuate around the long-term average, which is usually between 25 and 30. And our fawn-to-doe ratios decline below the long-term average, which is about 50 per 100 from between 2015 and 2017, but they rebounded the last 2 years and have been up more towards that normal level. And so we don't have any proposed changes for general or special permit seasons there as well. The other thing that I need to point out with the Palouse is there's a lot of balancing that goes on with maintaining deer numbers in that zone and balancing it with conflicts with agriculture. And so that's always something that's at play there. So with that, we'll move up to the northeast. I know there's a lot of interest in our white-tailed deer populations up there. I'll just start by saying that we don't have any proposed changes to general or special permit seasons. And again, if you look at it at a zonal level, including general season harvests, you know, antlerless and antlered, we see a decline again this year, primarily being driven by that elimination of general season opportunities to harvest antlerless deer. So as we move forward and get into more detail in this area, so District 1, by administrative definition, District 1 includes GMU 101, but as I mentioned, that's part of the Okanagan Highlands whitetail deer management zone. In addition, if you break down our harvest by species in that zone, 40% of the harvest is mule deer. And so we're primarily focusing on white-tailed deer from this point forward. So in the graphs that I have from this point forward, GMU 101 is not included. I also want to clarify that GMU 124, Mount Spokane, technically that's part of the Selkirk zone, but again, we're going to focus on District 1, and so we're going to take that out as well. So starting with our surveys, we have a long-standing preseason survey effort that has occurred in that district. Our buck to doe ratios, you don't see much variation in that data. The long-term trend since 2000, over the last 20 years, you could say there's, you know, a very slight increase maybe there, but not much going on. Our fawn to doe ratios, long-term trend would indicate that over time, you know, from what we were seeing 20 years ago, that there has been a slight decline in our fawn to doe ratios. The one thing I do think we need to clarify is that I view this as an index of that fawn to doe ratio, and the reason I do that is because these observed fawn to doe ratios, even back when they were higher, would not support an increasing deer population. I mean, there's just no way, especially at this, these are done in August and September historically. And if your fawn to doe ratio is that low, there's no way for that population is going to increase. You usually need to be in the range of 60 to 70 fawns in December to expect a population increase. And so I view these as an index, but I think they probably are appropriate, and they show variation that is real. So if we look at District 1 at the at-risk assessment, so everything that I've done from this point forward has included all general season harvest, antlered and antlerless. From this point forward, we're going to limit that down to just include antlered. This is one of the few places in the state where we have substantial general season antlerless harvest that occurs during our general seasons, and that opportunity has fluctuated quite a bit, whereas opportunities to harvest bucks has not. And so limiting your general season harvest to only include bucks is probably going to be more representative of what the true population trend was doing. So we've got four figures up here. So by definition, we are to use the 10-year average, which is what the top left figure does. And the bars that are being used to generate the average have the red shade. So looking at that, we don't meet the criteria. But we know that we had antler point restrictions and from 2011 to 2014. And so it may not be fair to include those 4 years into your average because we know that resulted in less harvest. And so I also looked at it by saying, okay, let's use the 10 most recent years where we had similar opportunities to harvest bucks, you know, no antler point restrictions. So that's what that top right figure is looking at. And then I also looked at it from, you know, let's just take the deepest look that we can at this. Let's include the 2001 to 2010. If we use that 10-year mean, we still don't meet the criteria. And then finally, over the last 20 years, I just used what's the highest 10 years of harvest that have occurred over the last 10 years, generated that 10-year mean, and we don't meet the criteria using that either. If we break it down to at the GMU level, those top four are GMUs where we did not have antler point restrictions. So for those GMUs, I use the definition as it's defined, the most recent 10 years. But I still think in the GMUs where we had antler point restrictions, I think it's more appropriate to use those 10 most recent years where the harvest opportunity was the same and comparable. And so that's what you see for GMU 117 and 121. So the other thing I need to emphasize here is, so when you look at GMUs 117 and 121, and we'll have a figure up here in a bit that kind of shows when we don't have antler point restrictions in those GMUs, we expect about 50% of our harvest to be less than 4 points, and roughly 50% will be 4 point or 5 point. So when you look at those figures, especially the one in 2011, you basically have to imagine that thing times two, right? Because right now, the way it's presented there, it's kind of deceptive. Because if we would have had any, so we're just above 500 in GMU 121. If we had not had antler point restrictions, we probably would have killed another 500 bucks in that year. And the years beyond that, I'm guessing you're probably in the range of like 30% higher than what those bars indicate. So looking at hunter numbers, what you'll see as we go through hunter numbers is they tend to follow the deer population. Because I think hunters, they see it on the landscape and they see those fluctuations. Word gets out, deer hunting was good in District 1, recruits more hunters. So we saw higher hunter numbers from 2001 to 2010. As that population started to decline, our deer hunters' numbers started to decline with it. We saw that reduction in hunter numbers when we implemented antler point restrictions. And then as we pulled those back, hunter numbers came back up to levels that were similar to 2010. And then as that population has declined the last 4 years, we've seen a hunter response and hunter numbers decline again, back to levels that we were observing when we had antler point restrictions. If we break it down to a GMU level, that trend isn't the same in every GMU. In GMU 105, there's just been this steady decline of hunter numbers in that GMU. In GMUs 108, 111, 113, there's not a lot of variation. Definitely saw a dip this year in 111. The red bars are indicating those were the years that we had antler point restrictions, and in those three GMUs, we don't see really any change in hunter numbers when we had antler point restrictions. But as we move down to 117 and 121, we'd see a substantial reduction in hunter numbers in response to those antler point restrictions. And after we pulled those back, hunter numbers came back up, but they have declined the last 4 years, 4 or 5 years, as that population's declined. Hunter success overall in this district over the past 20 years, the average has been 29%. Again, we see hunter success follow very similar trends to what our harvest and the population's done. We break it down to a GMU level. Not every GMU is created equal in District 1 when it comes to hunter success. If you've got a same color star, you're very similar. So GMU 111 and GMU 117, very similar long-term average of 27%. Both of those GMUs also kind of have reached up around that 30% range a couple times. When you move into 121 and 108, long-term average has been a little bit higher, 33%, and those are the GMUs that have had years where they've pushed the limits of around 40% success rates for hunters. GMU 113 is probably the place not to go whitetail deer hunting in District 1. Quite a bit lower success rates, hovering around that 20% range. in all GMUs, success rates were increasing, you know, from that 2001 to 2015 range, except in GMU 113. We don't see it as strong there. So if we look at, I kind of hit on this earlier, if we look at what's the composition of our harvest, our buck harvest, and what's the proportion of that harvest that's 4 to 5 point bucks, if you look at those GMUs, everybody's kind of hovering around that 45%, you know, mark. The main point to make there is that in a lot of states where they've implemented antler point restrictions for white-tailed deer, they've done that because 80% of their harvest is yearlings. And so I think what they've done to implement those rules is probably getting their harvest something like this, you know, in terms of like what's the age structure of that harvest. It's kind of an, I've made this point before, it's an apple and oranges comparison. I mean, the states that have done this in the Midwest and the East, they were really trying to increase the survival of those yearling bucks because in the studies that they 80% of their yearling bucks were getting shot. So very different. If we zoom into 117 and 121, so the other thing I should have pointed out was my figures only go up to 70%, but that green bar actually goes up to 100%. I zoomed it in so that we could see the, you know, the variation, just to clarify that. So as expected in 117 and 121, those years we had antler point restrictions, all of our harvest was 4 to 5 point bucks. There's a lot of argument that those restrictions resulted in a lot more older bucks, a lot more 4 and 5 point bucks, you know, or older bucks on the landscape. So after we pulled that away and went back to an any buck harvest, if there really was this residual, you know, population of mature bucks that had increased in response to that, then you should have seen probably a residual effect. So that first year, you would have seen a higher percentage of 4 to 5 points in the harvest than what you had historically. In GMU 117, we don't really see that. As soon as we pull, you know, go back to the any buck strategy, our percentage of 4 or 5 points goes right back down to where we were. That's not necessarily the case for 121. There's actually some evidence in 121 that says, hey, maybe there were, because even after we pulled back, that percentage stayed a little bit higher than what we were seeing previously, and then you just kind of saw it, you see it kind of taper down a little bit back to where it was normally.
If I may, I just want to let you know that we're about 25 minutes behind our schedule now.
Okay.
And we have a very, very full plate. And we have a significant number of the public at once. And I'm not trying to rush you, but we got a lot we got to get through. So
he's telling us.
Kind of refine the briefing because we're looking to hear what you have to say. We're looking certainly to hear from the public because that's why we're here as well.
Absolutely.
And then we'll deal with it next month, hopefully in a pragmatic way. Fair enough?
I'll fly through these last two.
Thank you.
Yep. So we did some regional comparisons. We pulled harvest data from Idaho and Montana. Very similar season structures between the two and what we do. This is data from 2009 to 2018, and we see a very similar trend in all three, in all the four of the regions that we looked at. District 1's down in the bottom right there. When you see this kind of similarity across that large of an ecoregion, there's abiotic factors that are at play here. There's very different season structures for both prey and predators across those regions. There's different habitat. All those factors are different, but yet we see very similar trends in harvests. So antler point restrictions, although they've shown minimal biological benefits, they remain popular with many hunters, and we have to acknowledge that. Because of that popularity, they do warrant consideration as a social issue. We've committed to considering antler point restrictions during the 2021-2023 season setting process. But if we do that, there's been a lot of research done that says if you do that, there needs to be extensive public outreach and support when you move that forward. So public comment, the common themes including reducing antlerless harvest, predator management, antler point restrictions, The department's already eliminated or substantially reduced antlerless harvest in areas where it was warranted. We've already liberalized bear seasons and proposed changes to cougar seasons, and the department's committed to considering antler point restrictions in the next three-year season setting package. And I do apologize for going over, but I knew I would.
Any questions? Hearing none. We do not have any public testimony under the one you just completed, but under the next one, we have a significant pile under number 8.
Oh, okay.
And that's the one you had listed for 40 minutes, including public comments. So we're already behind.
No, I think you're.
I'm sorry. I stand corrected. My pile got moved over. So.
But you have one more section to 8.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that wrap up?
That wraps up deer general seasons and special permits.
Okay.
And I gotta believe, looking at my audience behind me, I gotta believe there's some public testimony on that.
That was 8.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead. Are you wrapped up with no questions?
Yeah, my presentation is done, unless you guys have other questions.
Anyone else? We will get, you can take a break a few minutes, and we'll bring the public up for their period of comments. I think all of you here probably know how we do this. I'm going to call you up two at a time in the spirit of not touching each other. Al Martz and Dale Maggard first, please.
Hey, commissioners, director, my name is Al Martz. I'm co-chair of the Northeast Washington Wildlife Group, and my comments here today will all be directed toward District 1. In the Whitetail Deer Management Plan prior to 2017, the deer population was determined by deer counted per driven mile. With the stroke of a pen, this was dropped because the counts were 30, 40, even 50% below objective. Now the population is determined by harvest. If the harvest drops 25% or more from the previous 10-year average for two consecutive years, management action is required. The problem is with harvest declines of 10 to 20% a year for the last 5 years, this sliding average or population goal drops year after year. You could actually end up with no deer and never meet the 25% rule. So now we can lose all our deer to predators and mismanagement, and our population goal will look just fine. I testified at the September 2015 commission meeting in Spokane that the decision to remove the antler point restrictions and greatly increase the doe harvest will prove to be the worst management decision by the department and commission in District 1 for many years. Now, 4 years later, you have set all kinds of records. Record high cougar numbers, complaints, incidents, record low fawn doe ratios, record low 5-point plus antler deer, and record low hunter numbers, as well as record low harvests. The department said APRs didn't observe any biological effect, and there was no appreciable difference between GMUs where you implemented APRs and those you didn't. The two GMUs are 117 and 121. After the fourth and last year, the department website said, Hunting Prospects District 1 Modern Firearm last three-year average, GMU 121 was ranked number one best overall deer hunting opportunity. This was after 4 years of APRs, and 121 also had the best success rate of all of District 1. No appreciable difference. Ranked number one on all four-point or better. So don't tell me APRs don't work and bring them back youth exempt for whitetail in GMUs 105 through 121 as 75% of people in our survey agreed. The department always has excuses for a lousy hunting season. Habitat, disease, weather, hot, cold, wet, dry, never management. Be conservative, put more bucks in the landscape, and keep the doe harvest at zero until herds recover and knock down the predator numbers, especially cougars. Thank you.
Thank you, Director, Commissioners. My name is Dale Maggart, and except for 6 years, I've lived in Northeast Washington. For the last 40 years, just near Deer Park, just north of Spokane. I'm 70 years old, and I've never seen the deer numbers in Stevens County as low as they are right now. I've got a little bit different take than Al does here on deer management. The four options that the department is proposing will do very little to solve the cougar crisis we have in Northeast Washington. For years, hunters, loggers, outdoorsmen, and local citizens have been saying we have more and more cougars, but the department's biologists and big game managers kept telling us that the cougar density was 2.1 cougars per 100 square kilometers. In fact, I was even told that it was the one thing they had learned for sure after 20-plus consecutive years of cougar studies. Now I find it interesting that two of the options put forth have the guidelines based on 4.0 plus or minus cougars per 100 square kilometers. So, with the stroke of a pen, science be damned, the department doubles the number of cougars in Northeast Washington. It's too little and it's too late. If the commission should decide to direct the department to change the cougar season per Northeast Washington Wildlife Group's plan, or set the guidelines based on a 7.0 cougars per 100 square kilometers, and why not? You can do it with a stroke of a pen, and you would be closer to reality than 2.1 or 4.0, and even then, without hounds, the department admits we will not take out very many more cats than what is already being there. Then, if that's the case, I recommend a 4.8 APR, as Al does, no doe harvest for any user group, and the elimination of the late season in all of District 1 until deer numbers improve. But if the commission buys one of the options the department recommends, then I will not advocate for any of the above. Using some comments from our survey and the department's own statements about predators controlling their own numbers when the prey base collapses, of course, you know, that means we have to lose more pets, more livestock, probably some kids first. Then I say, let's hurry the collapse and let the hunters take as many of the deer, elk, and moose as they can. So eliminate any required tags or issue multiple ones. Open the season year-round for all species of ungulates with no sex restrictions. And let hunters put meat in the freezer one last time rather than prolong the agony and feed the predators for a couple more years. With these changes, you could charge 2, 3, and 4 times what a license currently costs. You might as well kill a golden goose and be done with it rather than pulling a few feathers at a time, losing hunters every year as is happening now. Thank you.
My title is Northeast Washington, or Northeast Whitetail Deer Crisis. My name is John Maggart. I'm chair of the Northeast Washington Wildlife Group. I've seen a lot of you people here before. I'm here to testify as a lifelong hunter and conservationist in Northeast Washington. And usually I speak, it'll just ad lib it, but I wrote this out because my memory ain't what it used to be. Never in the history of Northeast Washington white-tailed deer has there been more of a need for conservation of the species. With deer numbers at an all-time low, along with hunter participation, it is time to pull out the stops and take all measures possible to bring deer numbers back to sustainable levels. Decreased antlerless harvest is the only tool used by the department, and it falls way short of bringing our deer numbers back. Adding more does to the landscape dilutes the buck population. Buck numbers also need to increase at the same time. Otherwise, does are not bred on time during the first and second estrus. They will be bred later, as there are not enough bucks to get the job done. Fawns are born later each year, causing increased predation, poor winter survival, and poor health of the fawns in general. Fawn recruitment into the first year of life is extremely low. Conservation and control of the buck deer harvest is just as important as conservative doe harvest. Antler point restrictions address a much needed conservation measure for the whitetail of Northeast Washington. Because our deer numbers are the lowest they have ever been, we suggest a four-point antler restriction on whitetail bucks for GM ewes 105 through 121. Youth hunters would still be able to harvest any buck. The antler point restriction worked from 2011 to 2014 in units 117 and 121. You're familiar with those. In 2014, GMU 121 had the highest hunter success rate of all the Northeast units. In GMU's 117 and 121, the two APR units, 329 more four-point bucks were killed than the previous year, 2013. In 2014, units 105, 108, 111, and 113 combined harvested two less bucks than the previous year, 2013. APRs do make a difference, contrary to what the department says and has said. In a recent survey conducted by our group, 65% did not know that GMU 121 had that high hunter success the last year of the four-point APR. That's not something that was publicized. 75% of those surveyed now support the four-point restriction, just like us testifying today. These people surveyed know our deer are in trouble, and measures like this are the only hope for saving what's left of our whitetail. We saw firsthand that 4 years ago, or 4 years of APR was working. We agree with not taking antlerless deer right now, at least until we see some documented herd recovery. Antlerless harvest should remain low. The department uses every excuse in the book, except for bad management, to justify the deer numbers being low. Habitat is the go-to word now. Blame it on habitat. Baloney. Too many cougars have decimated the deer numbers, yet you're afraid to take too many cougars, and you'll never hear anyone in the department profess having too many cougars. So you just let them eat our deer into extinction. The department needs to get off the political, bureaucratic bandwagon and take steps to save our Northeast whitetail. The four-point restriction is one of those management steps that does work. Proper management is needed now, but later. And I added one sentence to this after listening to Brock. And, some of Brock's presentation was okay with me, but expect that to be rebutted in some areas, especially the Northeast. We're not buying into all this drought stuff, and we're not buying into a whole bunch of stuff. 90% of what's going on right now is predation. You got a decreased herd, and you have predation going on at an extreme rate. And it's not going to come back. Something needs to be done. Thank you.
I'm Freddie Giannacchini, and I'm a director with the Northeast Washington Wildlife Group. And I was very impressed with Brock Haines's presentation. I went over it for quite a few hours last night from start to finish. The commission is not getting all the information they need to have. The information that he has given, he said himself, we could not sustain our herds with a buck to doe or a fawn to doe ratio where it's been over the last 10 years. In 2015, he also said because of the drought, he saw the blue tongue widespread in all the bodies that they found. They came out on less than 15. They didn't see all the bodies. They stated that the blue tongue in 2015 was no worse than any other year. Okay? And then proceeded to harvest 1,881 does that season in District 1. Okay? 7,900 deer were harvested. That was after the four-point had raised the number of deer in the area exponentially. So we had a blue tongue epidemic, we had the drought, and we had the department harvesting 1,881 does on an already depleted population. And from that point, the harvest has continued to go down each and every year to where it's 50% below where it was in 15. And if you look at 2007, 2008, Those are the two hard winters we had back to back, and anyone that lives here, lived here then knows that. 2009, they didn't withdraw harvesting antlerless, which has been their key. It wasn't until 2010, and then the harvest was going in the tank. And if you look at the graph from 2007 to 2011, it's on a steady decline. It's, and then when you add in the predators and adding in the wolf, there is no hope for our whitetail unless we do everything that we can proactively. Institute an APR, John just said, and Al just said, how much it helped. That was a 15% increase in the two four-point areas between 13 and 14, and a negative decrease in all the other GMUs in that unit. So we need to work on hunter opportunity if we want people to actually purchase a license in Washington, especially in northeastern Washington, because it is killing not only the hunting heritage, but it's killing our economy in a tri-county area. The game department says that it's $64 a day per person spent during the season. Our decrease in hunters from 25,000 down to 17,000 from 2004 to 19, that's $1.6 million a day we lose in our community. We can't tolerate it any longer. So we'd like you to put in the four point antler point restriction. Regarding youth, they would be able to shoot any buck and continue the antlerless until our herds start to come back. Thank you.
Can I say one more thing before I step away? We talked about the new whitetail plan, which wouldn't be instituted till 2021, and Brock talked about putting the four-point in then. We think we need it now, not then. Right now.
I'll keep mine fairly short because I basically just piggybacking off of these guys, but there's about 600 or 700 combined years sitting back there, and these guys are passionate, and you guys need to believe what they say. They're not making, they can't even make this stuff up. I think the real monkey in the room is the wolves have disrupted the entire region, and you know, the cougars are displaced, they're eating everything out of house and home, and drastic times, we gotta take drastic measures. So, you know, the four-point restriction is one tool. I don't know how hard it would be to implement back into, you know, baiting bears or using hounds or whatever, but it's a real issue. So I really think I would invite all of you to come to Northeast Washington and try to witness what they're saying so you can believe it and witness it. But these guys have all lived there for, you know, 70, 80 years. They've seen the highs and the lows, and they've never seen it this low. And I've, you know, been there my whole life as well, and I've never seen it this bad. So thanks. That's all I got.
Being a past commissioner, you get a little more time than you need to.
I have a few comments. I think I'll be pretty much on time, but I'll reserve some of it.
I wanted to thank you for what you did on the stock market today.
Yeah, not nearly as much as my wife thanks you and my clients thank you.
There's a stockbroker for those of you that don't know.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and the chairman and commissioners, it's my pleasure to have a chance to address you from this side of the table. I'll be brief, and I'm going to approach this a little differently, having kind of sat in your chair for a while. The deer population is, I think, the key focus for you. I know you're facing with a lot of cattlemen conflict with predators, a lack of revenue in the department, a lot of safety problem with people in the communities. You got problems with any kinds of hunter capacity and dissatisfaction with their ability to have a satisfactory hunt. And it all revolves around one issue, and that's food. The ungulates are the key source of food, and it's because of the predators and the overharvest and the mismanagement of the department, there is not enough food left for all those positions. If you would solve the food problem, you'd get the cattle relief, you get the hunters back, you get the revenue back, and you solve the safety problems. But right now, the department has managed that ungulate herd that's feeding all those things down to a level that the predators are now on top of everybody because they're hungry. You can do all the side tractions you want, range riders, hazing. They're not going to stop because they're going to go eat. And they're eating everything. And we probably are looking at another 75 to 125 wolves this year. That's probably another 2,000 to 6,000 ungulates that are going to be eaten in the next 12 months. Where our harvest used to run around 8,000 to 10,000, is now down to 4,000 or less. And as Brock said, our fawn recruitment is below recovery levels. So the only hope is for you guys to step up and figure out how can we get the food supply back up. And this food supply is going to be dependent upon what you set for the white-tailed deer harvest and what you do on the predator management. Because this is a problem solution. It's not the problem causing. The weather has constantly been the problem by the department, never been an answer. I'd like to take just a second on the questions the commissioners ask on the 25% rule. When I was in your chair, we had trouble with predator management. And so we put the 25% rule to try to make the department follow a policy that if you had a 25% decrease in predator-prey ratios, you had to address predators. And so we put it in the whitetail plan, and we put it in the wolf plan, and we put it in the wildlife management plan. We put it in there three times because the department thinks they're smarter than you are, and they don't have to follow policy. And they think they can do a three-year study, and you guys will be off the commission, and they won't have to answer it. And if they can't get you off the three-year thing, they'll put it into the three-year deer policy, and it'll defer the decision out. The only reason there was a three-year game management plan cycle was to make it easier on the staff. It did no value to the wildlife. And so you got to make sure that we're doing stuff. As they mentioned, we're at a turning point. One more year on our current management, on the ungulates, and on the predators, it's over. The cattle will be suffering. We'll probably lose a lot of cattlemen. We're losing businesses. We're losing jobs. Because the hunters, we've gone 8,000 people out of Northeast Washington is a lot. So we need to solve the food supply. Go buy some sheep and cows or whatever you want, throw them out there. But the one thing you can't stop predators from doing is eating. And the wolves, the cougars, the coyotes, the bears, increase the number of permits in the spring. Get those bears and coyotes off the fawns. Increase the cougar harvest so that we can get them off the particularly the moose calves are just about gone. You can't find one in September. And as far as the deer go, they're all down in the valley hiding behind barns because the predators are pushing them down there. There's nothing left on public land. So this is really key. I think that one thing, if I had one thing you guys could do this year, is really come up with an ungulate hunting season that will recover them to solve these other problems. because we're headed for a major wreck in Northeast Washington. I'll take any questions if anybody's got any.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
So, oh, thank you. Mr. Chair and Commissioners, Director, members, Wes McCart, Stevens County Commissioner.
I want to give you some firsthand information on this. One, I support the fact that you're not having any antlerless in our Selkirk area. I happen to live in GMU 121, just out of Springdale. A few years ago, I had my neighbor's cows get out, and I took my three-wheeler out of the shop just after dusk, and I went out in my field, and I started to chase those cows back, and I couldn't figure out what direction to run my bike without running over deer that were bedded down in my field. I've always slept in the summer with my windows open, and you hear the different predators taking the fawns all summer long. I'm here to tell you that I don't get to hear that anymore, which is somewhat of a relief. But it's not a relief for a good reason. This year, I had one doe and one fawn on my 178 acres. That was on my place. When I would come down the driveway, come down the road, the dirt road in my area, I could easily, within the three fields, in any direction that are up against the trees, count hundreds of deer in nothing flat. This year I struggled to ever count more than 20. You have a problem with the population in our area, with the deer population in our area. We cannot afford to do status quo hunting in those opportunities, and then say, oh, we're going to figure out what to do with the prey. We have been overrun with wolves. We've been overrun with cougars. I can tell you coyotes are just as big a problem out there for those fawns. You guys, have to implement something to the hunting rules this year in our area in order to let this population recover. Now, I'm a hay grower. That 170 acres, I'm not a huge fan of having a whole lot of deer out there. To me, they're like having a bunch of gophers out there, right? Not a good thing. But I'm here to tell you, you are at a crisis level with the number of deer that are out there. And I'm not just hearing this from just mine. I wanted to give you my personal input on what I'm seeing in my place. I'm hearing that from farmers all over. I'm hearing people that are going into the wedge, working their cattle, or up in the different ranges and working their cattle. And they're coming back and saying, I went out all day long and never saw a deer. And that's never happened to me before. These are things that as a commissioner, I hear over and over and over all summer, all winter. You need to look at these hunting regulations. You need to look at the decline in the population, and you need to say, folks, I can either take drastic actions and cut down the number of hunters that I have out in my area and take it in the shorts for a year or two and try and recover this population, or you can continue to watch it crash. And economically, it is not helping our county. We really need you to take some drastic actions now. Those graphs, they might tell you a little bit of the story, but I'm here to tell you they're not telling you the whole story. If you're out there every day like I am out on the ground, when I come home and I'm not able to see them anymore, when my area is one of the most prolific areas for deer probably anywhere in the state, you have a problem. Please help us solve that. Thank you.
Mike Palmer, Stevens County, all my life. I've seen some severe winters of the 60s through the 80s. Deep snow would drive deer to the valleys for survival. Wright's Mountain is close to Chewila and Highway 395, Unit 121. You could easily count 500 to 600 deer driving around the base. Fast forward to the winter of 2018-19. Deep snow drove the deer to Wright's Mountain and in the valleys. The times I drove around the base, twice I saw about 30 deer, but usually 5 to 10. A 4-point minimum is a must. At this point, we need much more. Our game herds are vanishing, and it's because of wolves and cougars, not a lack of forage, because of forest fires and black tongue, as I heard a comment from a biologist. Point is here, our deer herd is in serious trouble. Based on my observation, I feel the commission are receiving bogus data from sources you are relying on. Pets and livestock have been being killed and in staggering numbers for a long time now by wolves and cougars. Human safety is at high risk. Children, grandchildren will be killed. It is going to happen, and soon. Everybody should be able to go out and enjoy Mother Nature without the fear of being attacked by predators. Thank you.
Chairman, are we done with public testimony then?
We are.
And I had a question for staff before you go to agenda item 9.
Very good.
Is that appropriate? So this is the process question of what we have for options in front of us when we get to April. So we heard some testimony here that said things were more critical than what some of the statistics that we've seen show. In fact, the county commissioner at the end said things are extremely severe. So the staff recommendation, I think, in these deer regulations is very close to no change. And so when we get to April, I have a question about that and then a question about economics. But when we get to April, what options are in front of us that stay within this annual thing, and what stays, which is, and what is on the other side of a 3-year process? For example, we've had recommendation to go to a 4-point rule, and I'm going to presume that's eligible for us to decide in April, although I don't see that in the presentation. Or if we thought things were much worse than that, if commissioner thought that and wanted to do more and squeeze the season even more, is that an option in April? So the question is, what's available in April to us?
Yeah, so I think there's always that flexibility to consider those as an option. I would recommend against that. I mean, I would strongly encourage you not to do that. You know, it is very clear from places that have implemented antler point restrictions, there needs to be extensive outreach on that issue, and you need to have a lot of support to do that. We don't have that. Like, we don't have the outreach. We haven't done that. I can tell you that based on our past responsive management survey that we did in 2008, it didn't get specifically at what we're considering here, but the question was asked of our hunters, would you support 3-point minimum antler point restrictions for whitetail deer in Northeast, you know, in Washington? And our hunters were pretty evenly split on that. And so I know we're here today hearing a lot of testimony from hunters that support that rule, but there's a lot of hunters out there that don't as well. And so I would caution, you know, against considering that without doing the public outreach piece and getting that input.
So I'm going to take from that answer that there's a question whether this March-April process even constitutes public outreach on what range of options that are even available to us. But what I did hear you say is it is available to us in April, technically. My question on economics is that if you did go to a four-point restriction, and it showed much less of a take, does that affect the economics? We heard an average of $68 a day, and last time I took my family hunting to the Northeast and my wife took a look at the checkbook, I had to tell her that $68 is what they charge for lunch up there and to try to explain how all that was. But is there a drop-off in participation in economics that goes along with a four-point restriction, or do you see about the same number of hunters?
So, I mean, no. So we can go back. I mean, let's go back to the hunter number slides. And so if we go back to this slide, if you look at the GMUs at the top, that's where we didn't have antler point restrictions there. And we didn't see much of a change in hunter numbers. We definitely saw that in 117 and 121. We've kind of dropped back to levels. We've seen a decline in hunter numbers the last 4 years to levels that were similar to when we had antler point restrictions. I fully expect if you implement those in the GMUs that you implement antler point restrictions, that hunter number is going to drop just like it did from 2010 to 2011. And so, yeah, I think the answer is yes. And the thing about 117 and 121 is they drive this region. Those other GMUs are much smaller. There's a lot less deer harvest, a lot less hunter numbers. And so essentially when I summarize this stuff at a district level, it's really 117 and 121 that's driving what you see in those figures, which is why we broke it down to GMU level. But I would anticipate a decline in hunter numbers if we did that.
Just maybe to clarify that, hunter participation in the GMU may not directly mean a reduction in hunter license sales. So they may go to a different GMU to hunt, or they may go somewhere else. So I guess the correlation isn't straight one-to-one is what I'm trying to get at. And so, yeah, we may see, depending on how wide-ranging the four-point restriction is, whether it's one GMU, two GMUs, or all the GMUs in District 1, if you do all the GMUs in District 1, then you may have maybe a reduced participation. But if it's the same as maybe it was back in those years, then you might just see shifting in where people go. So it's not a clear one-to-one ratio.
And your first question was related to, you know, considering additional adjustments to the season and if we could do that. Well, we've pulled all the antlerless harvest out of the system, and there's just no evidence in the literature that indicates that you need more bucks on this landscape to influence reproductive potential. I had some other slides here as references. Antler point restrictions have been around a while. But really the only research that's been done on them was looking at how did it affect hunter participation, how did it affect the buck segment of the population, because again, they were primarily interested in that yearling buck component. Last year, there was a study published in Pennsylvania where they said, hey, we've done this for a while. We've been collecting all these reproductive parameters, information on all these reproductive parameters. That's the first paper that's out there that kind of looked at it, and they found no effect on increasing the number of mature bucks in their population. They were looking at fetal rates, they were looking at conception dates, and they found no effect. Additionally, an extensive body of literature has been done on white-tailed deer in the Southeast, and most of that comes out of Mississippi State University. And they actually used genetic analysis over several studies where they've looked at, okay, we've got more mature bucks over here, we implemented, who's doing the breeding? And using genetics, they found out that whether you have a population dominated by younger age bucks versus a population where you've increased the number of mature bucks, a lot of those yearlings are still doing the breeding. They actually didn't see much difference, in fact. And so I think it's the nature of how white-tailed deer reproduce in the system. It's a chaotic system with bucks chasing does, but they just found no effect. And so I don't see a biological reason why we would consider even shortening the seasons that we have up there, because there is no antlerless harvest in that system right now.
Commissioner Lindblom?
So, surprise, I'm going to push back a little bit. Mm-hmm. When you say that you would not, you know, recommend any of these changes, I just want to make sure that we're not saying we're not going to recommend any changes because we're trying to avoid an ass chewing. Oh, sorry. Sorry. That's is this a moment where we need to have some leadership here and not feel terribly concerned about that we're going to get some pretty strong pushback? Because I hear what you say about that it's, there's no, you know, scientific evidence. And I would say Pennsylvania and Louisiana are very, very different, probably, systems than we have here in Washington mm-hmm. State. But I haven't heard you say, oh, that's going to be catastrophic to the population if we try something new. And so I just want to make sure that we aren't avoiding trying something new and seeing if it works for our state just because we don't want to be unpopular.
No, I think we're completely open to considering it. I think we have to consider all of our hunter values, though. And what I'm saying is that we're hearing a lot of support for antler point restrictions here, but there's a lot of our hunters that don't support that approach. It's a social issue to me. So I don't think there's also, you'll also hear some counter argue that antler point restrictions may actually do the opposite of what you want them to do, because now you're focusing all the hunter effort on mature bucks. You're taking the hunter that would have been happy shooting a spike or a 2-point, and now you're forcing them to seek out a mature buck to shoot it. There's actually, on whitetail, no data to make, you know, support that argument either. I think it's a wash. I think it's a social issue. I think they are highly popular, and because of that, we should consider it. But we got to do our homework on it, and we've got to do it right.
Do we have time to do our homework, I guess, is what I'm concerned about.
Yeah, well, I'm going to make a statement in a minute. Gary, you go ahead. As a courtesy, I'll let you speak in a second.
That coming through. The actual numbers, when we went to the 4-point, increased hunter participation in 121 and 117. We used the department's data only, and the numbers show that those two units increased by 5.2% over that period. The other GMUs without it decreased by 5%. We get tired of them manipulating the numbers, trying to misinform you guys about what the impact is. 4-point is a conservation effort, and most of the hunters who are diehard hunters know we're in trouble, and they're willing to take less to get more in the future. So we will have maybe a short-term setback, but this proves from a previous study that it does increase participation, and the hunters come back. And this is off your stats if you want to take a look at it. But what they're telling you is not true.
Well, we're going to wrap this one up, but I just want to say, you know, this sounds like an issue to me that's, no matter what we do, it's going to be controversial with some. But the some that you're talking about aren't here. These folks in front of us today that made public comment, they've been coming here as long as I've been on the commission, mostly the same faces with most of the same message. And I don't think they're making it up. It's certainly their interpretation. So I think my personal, one individual, I think we need to think out of the box a little bit going forward to see if we can't find a different pathway forward that solves a multitude of problems. End of statement. Thank you.
Okay. Eric did want me to emphasize that because antler point restrictions weren't part of the recommendation, that there has not been that public outreach on this issue. There's a lot of the public that didn't know that we might consider that. And so that should be considered if moving into the April meeting.
Well, how are you going to do that in 21 days to our next meeting?
No, I think he just wanted me to highlight that there hasn't been any of that public.
Yeah, I know, but we got to make a decision in the April meeting.
Right, Mr. Chair, Commission, I think the our process here is we have a six-year game management plan, and then we do a three-year season setting where we contemplate larger, more significant social changes such as APR. So this is not one of those years. Our proposals, this is one of the smaller cycles where we look at smaller changes, and our commitment and discussion with the folks who came today is that we hear them and that we will address the issue through our three-year season setting process, but it has not been a part of this particular recommendation. So that is why Brock's recommendation would be to not go there right now, because we have not done that. It doesn't mean we don't haven't committed to doing that. If you were to choose to do so, you would just, you know, do it with the understanding that we had not brought that forward through the standard three-year process with the full robust public process to contemplate the issue, so that you would be hearing all voices on the issue here today, because it was not one of the rule proposals. So just clarity there. But
you're not suggesting that, I mean, if we decide to bring that forward, we certainly have the authority to do that.
I believe that's true, but I would want to make sure that we had public noticed it properly, and that our constituents were aware that that change was a possible change, and that they had opportunity to comment on it. It is fairly different, and that would normally be expected to be addressed through the three-year plan. So I do think there's a legitimate question to be asked of how could we do that in the time that we have and meet that need to show that we had noticed the public.
I get it. Yeah. I get it. Molly, Commissioner Linville, please, and then Commissioner Thorburn. Yeah. And then Commissioner McKenzie.
So I always, when I nosedive at something, which is pretty regular, I always ask myself, so how's that working for you? And when you say, well, it's not part of our three-year standard plan, how's that three-year standard plan working for you?
Good question. I've been just through a couple cycles of that myself, and I recognize that there are challenges with that plan. I also recognize that there's challenges with going off cycle. So the Cougar discussions that we're going to have later today are an example where we decided collectively to take one of these issues and do it off cycle, and the workload associated with that and the engagement with the public is challenging. Now, could we reconsider our process? Yes, we certainly could, but right now our process and what we commit to the public is that they're going to be aware of these types of discussions on that three-year cycle and have the opportunity to engage. If we think we want to adjust that, we certainly should review that and look at it, but that is not our current operational system. So I think as we look at the next six-year game management plan and we think about what we do, if we'd like to address that, we should. But right now, we have not noticed the public of that level of change. So that would be just the thing to contemplate if you were to consider going there.
Mr. Thorburn?
I as somebody who sits and sort of hears this in two ears from local constituents, actually, I'll just point out that while this was not part of the package that's been put forward to the public, we did receive letters, pretty passionate letters, asking us not to act on it and to wait for the three-year process as as it's been presented by staff. So while we're saying, you know, we're not hearing it today, we have been hearing it, folks. We've gotten letters.
Mr. McKenzie.
Yeah, I'm kind of left with a little difficulty on what our process does allow then. So we've got a staff recommendation for the same as last year, as opposed to a suite of alternatives to choose from as we do for Cougar, or a suite of alternatives on a variety of other fishing things, for example. So if the commission decided to not go along with the staff recommendation, there's nothing else left. So in this business of big things every 3 years and small things every 1 year, if there isn't an option to change from the staff recommendation between March and April, that certainly, I'm sure, is not where we're at, because that would leave no purpose to the March and April process. Either adopt the staff recommendation, or you decline to, and it ends up at the staff recommendation. So I'm sure that's not the process that's there now.
If I may, I'll try to address that. We may ask Anise to step up, but our process, normal process, would be our six-year game management plan, which goes through a very extensive process, including SEPA review. And that SEPA review and that SEPA oversight is kind of what sets the umbrella for the management actions that we may take subsequent to that. Our current process would be that we would consider larger changes like the one being discussed today in a three-year timeline. And then in the off years, the off cycle, we are only traditionally looking at the smaller things like season dates, permit numbers, et cetera, but not necessarily larger social issues like methods of take and different ways to approach a hunt season. So in a way, yes, you are correct. We have not, the current process is designed to meter that out in that way. And so in an off cycle, we are bringing to you the more standard season setting and permit number type recommendations, and that's what we're coming to the commission for. It's not accept our recommendation or not. You have flexibility in the issues that are on the table today around those issues. If we know we want to take on a larger subject that requires more input, we would normally do that through our three-year. And in the case of Cougar, like we're talking about now, we were specifically asked to elevate that and do it off-cycle and do that more robust process. And so we've done that for Cougar, and we have not done that for APR. I don't know if that helps, but that's our system.
Mr. Linville.
I'm trying to understand where flexibility is.
So I think I would actually, before we speculate too much, I would like to know if the Attorney General could give us any advice on where your room for flexibility is based on what we've noticed in the CR 101, what we noticed in the CR 102. The concept is, does the public have appropriate notice that they would understand this would be the level of change considered? I would hearken back to previous commission decisions that have occasionally been challenged when that has been the very issue that led to the overturn of the commission decision. But that's more of a legal question. I don't know if it's possible to get any insight now or no.
I could.
So.
There is a specific statute in the Administrative Procedures Act that addresses deviation between a proposed rule presented to the governing body versus the final adoption by that governing body. That is RCW 3405-340. It specifically does allow an agency. So, well, first, let me step back. If the agency is considering substantive changes between the proposed rule that was put out in the CR 102, the statute encourages the agency to do a supplemental CR 102 and re-notice to the public. So that's what the statute pushes towards. But in acknowledgement of there being, you know, time constraints like annual hunting seasons, which you're stuck with the calendar year that you have, the statute does allow the agency to depart. And it's subsection 3 that addresses this. It does allow the agency to adopt a rule that varies in content from the proposed rule. Still has to be the same subject matter, but it's definitely the same subject matter. It's what should the deer regulations be, so I'm not concerned about that. And the agency needs to describe what those changes are. Once the agency does that, it opens a process for any individual to petition the agency to do further rulemaking regarding what those changes were. And then there's a separate aspect that I wasn't involved, and I don't know exactly what the legal mechanism was, such as the prior Cougar rules where the governor invalidated them. That wasn't under the statute, and I don't know what the exact legal procedure that was utilized there was. So that was another angle for someone to come in and attack a rule that varied from the proposal.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay. Thank you. We'll move